Since President Trump took office almost a month ago, a lot of protests have taken place around the nation and beyond. So far, we've seen the Women's March on Washington, yesterday's Day Without Latinos protest in Milwaukee, and many more. Here's a clip from a protest at JFK Airport last month after refugees had been detained inside because of President Trump's executive order on immigration.
While these protests often attract media attention and make headlines, there's still the big question of whether or not they work. And with so many protests taking place, is the message getting lost? Are protesters being heard?
David Meyer joins us now. He's a professor of sociology and political science at the University of California, Irvine. His books include The Politics of Protest, Social Movements in America, and he blogs at politicsoutdoors.com. David, thanks so much for joining us today.
I'm glad to be with you.
Well, from what we've seen so far, it looks like we're in for a lot of politics outdoors, a lot of protests in the Trump era. What do you make of this?
Well, it's extraordinary how quickly Trump's opponents have taken to the streets and have engaged on a whole range of political issues. And the Trump administration has been aggressive about trying to, you know, deliver on some of its promises that lots of Americans are offended by. And they see no profit in trying to work with him, and he's offered no opportunities for kind of a moderate opposition. So people are taking to the streets. It's unprecedented this soon in an administration to see this level of distrust and protest.
Right. During the Obama administration, we saw the Tea Party protests that took a while to develop, and it took the passage or the prospect of the passage of the Affordable Care Act, it seemed like, to really get things going. Looking back, before we focused more on the present day, were those protests effective, the Tea Party protests? And if so, what made them effective?
Well, the Tea Party protests followed a pattern of, well, let me start in a different way. Obama was a conventional politician in that he set up distinct priorities for the first year of his administration and invested a lot of political capital in the Affordable Care Act. And Tea Party demonstrators who didn't agree on everything agreed on stopping the Affordable Care Act. And they forced all of their political activity toward that end. And in the short run, they lost. You know, the Affordable Care Act was passed, but it became a talking point for Republicans for the last 7 years. So there was a kind of impact, even with a short-term defeat. I'd say the attitude of the Tea Party was adopted by many Republican candidates for office, and in some ways, Donald Trump is kind of the Frankenstein monster of the Tea Party organizations.
What is it that turns maybe a one-off protest or protests here and there into a movement that can have an impact beyond a big show of force on that one day?
That's exactly the question that everybody's grappling with. The question is, how do you sustain the energy, the intensity, and the commitment, and how do you spread the effort from the dramatic event like the Women's March or the airports protests to include conventional politics as well? So what makes it work, what makes protest work, is when it's operating in concert with more mainstream political actions like voting, like going to town meetings, like rallying, like writing and calling your congressman. And that's a hard trick to pull off. Right now, Democrats in the House of Representatives, and particularly in the Senate, have been a little more aggressive in opposing the Trump agenda than they otherwise would have been. And I think the protesters can claim credit for that for the moment.
I wonder how much of a bandwagon effect there is. If, say, during the Tea Party protests or now, if I'm looking at the Affordable Care Act and thinking, I don't know about this thing, or if I'm looking at the repeal of the Affordable Care Act and saying, I don't know about that, but I'm kind of on the fence, and then I see lots of other people out there protesting, does that maybe make me, who the passive viewer at home, more likely to join in on my side, whichever side that is?
Sure, sure. People have busy lives. They're concerned with lots of things. Everybody wants to get a good meal and spend time with their friends and study. Everybody does want to study. I hope that's true. And, do lots of different things. When people protest, when they think it's both necessary and potentially effective. When you see your friends out there, when you see people who look like you protesting, when you see people who look like your kids or your relatives or your cousins also protesting, it makes it more attractive and more visible, and it makes it seem like it's more likely to make a difference. You know, you looked at that State Department dissent cable just a week ago. The dissenters in the State Department have always had the opportunity to express their concerns through confidential and protected letters. And typically, a very successful one might get 24 signatures. The opposition to the Trump travel ban got 1,000 signatures. Now, it's a lot tougher to be signatory number 3 than the 700th or 800th person who signs a letter like that. It's a lot harder to stand on the street when you're by yourself than when you see 15 or 30 or 160 people yelling outside your congressman's office.
Talking to David Meyer from the University of California, Irvine, about the politics of protest in modern-day America. A lot of protests already under the Trump administration. David, looking at another protest of the fairly recent past, the Occupy movement, Occupy Wall Street and its various subsidiary branches. People criticize that for not having a focused message, maybe not having impact. I heard Senator Barney Frank talking about it, sympathetic with a lot of its goals. Very frustrated that they were very consciously not getting into electoral politics. Was there something that protesters from anywhere on the political spectrum can learn from that, maybe what not to do, or is there more to it than I'm saying?
Well, I think there's a lot to Occupy, but the occupations all across the country engaged lots and lots of people, and the most of them were completely committed to giving voice to the wide range of political commitments that people brought. They were also committed to a grassroots democratic style that made it very hard to get things done. And I think that consensus orientation is a huge obstacle to sustained engagement. Ultimately, all the occupiers could really agree on doing was continuing their efforts. So when the occupations were cleared out all at once, it was hard to find ways to continue collectively. What I think lots of observers like Barney Frank miss is the people who occupied didn't just go home or to graduate school. The occupiers fed out into a whole range of other causes. So I know that if you went to the Women's March, you would find veterans of Occupy. I know if you went to the Dakota Access Pipeline protest, you'd find occupiers. What disappeared after the occupations, however, was some sort of unifying label and agenda. And I think today's anti-Trump activists are going to have to work hard to cultivate connections between campaigns that seem disparate. You know, the Dakota Access Pipeline protests in North Dakota, the protests for reproductive rights in major cities, the protests against Betsy DeVos visiting the public schools. Well, those seem intuitively like separate campaigns. The activists have to work to forge connections among them.
Let's talk specifically about the Women's March. A lot of big numbers there. I think the organizers saw the turnout at least as a success when considering who turned out in Washington and at other smaller rallies around the country. Talk about that a little bit. How does that fit into recent protest history in the United States?
You know, it's hard to get reliable numbers, but that may have been the largest coordinating demonstration campaign ever in American history. The numbers I've seen are 2.6 to 3.6 million people on the same day, with maybe a half a million to three quarters of a million in Los Angeles, same number in Washington, D.C. And there's some academics who are doing crowdsourcing estimates, and they've got 16 people protesting in Beaver Island, Michigan. That's massive. That's incredible. And I think it reflects a lot of antipathy to the Trump agenda. And that's a promising sign. I think people will look back to that and think about ways they can carry that forward in other political campaigns. You know, when the airport protests happen, you could find people all over the country wearing those pussy hats that were, you know, the sign of the times for the Women's March, sort of making explicit connection with some sort of larger movement. So the big demonstration is like an exclamation point, and the exclamation point came early, but, you know, making substantive political change requires more than just one outburst, and we'll have to see if the activists are in it for the long haul.
Talking right now about the politics of protest in the Donald Trump era with David Meyer, professor of sociology and political science at the University of California, Irvine. Yesterday's Day Without Latinos protest in Milwaukee drew participation from thousands of demonstrators, one of many protests that's happened since President Trump took office. But will they change anything?
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think protest is an effective tool to create change? Have you recently participated in a protest, or are you planning on doing some protesting in the near future? And if so, why? Or do you think protesters should be doing something alternative, better with their time? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation about the politics of protest in the Trump era with David Meyer. He's a professor of sociology and political science at the University of California, Irvine. And with you as well at 800-642-1234.
Join us with your thoughts and questions about protests, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers. Chris is on the line in Madison. Chris, hi.
Hey, great show.
Thanks. What do you think?
Well, I work in a hospital, and I bartend part-time, so I talk to a lot of people. And to tell you the truth, most often I have heard people in, you know, tentative support of Donald Trump. And I'll tell you, most people are getting burned out by the news of all the protests and the lack of a coherent message. You know, what are they talking about now is a frequent comment I hear. And my roommate is first-generation American. His parents immigrated from Mexico, and he is not on board with all of it because he says it's just not fair. We're all about immigration. We just want it to be fair and legal, and I think that this current round of protests is going to burn itself out and turn other people off.
Chris, thanks a lot. Not much time left. I want to bring our guest in, but what do you think? Backlash, David?
Backlash has happened before, and there's absolutely no question that the Trump administration will try to discredit the demonstrators by saying that they're paid, or that they're radical, or that alternatively that they don't have any agenda at all. This is par for the course. What we have to keep in mind is American politics gives the advantage to the defense. It's easier to stop things from happening than to make things happen. And we've already seen the Trump administration kind of encounter stalls on policy toward Israel. The Republican Congress has been divided on what to do about health care. So there are tinkles of influence already. Is it going to make everybody happy? I don't think so.
Thanks for the call, Chris. We'll go next to Joe in Stevens Point. Joe, hi.
Hi. I do not have the ample time to protest what I feel, but I wish there was a unified message that said, not my president. Just simply put, from the hacks to everything that I believe he stands for to I don't think it was actually a legitimate presidency. And anyway, don't need to get into it all, but that's my unified message that I wish to protest.
Joe, thanks for the call. David, I mean, this isn't an organization of protesters that get to vote on a unified message. How does a movement come up with that kind of message?
Well, as I said, it's easier to say no, and it's easier to organize around no than to put forward something that is more proactive and comprehensive. American institutions give an advantage to stopping things. What likely happens, and this movement is developing in opposition, is that they poke and poke and poke at the administration and see where the supports start to fall out. And you're already seeing Republican members of Congress defect from the administration on some issues, like relations with Russia, like health care reform. And does a unified message come out? Maybe not, except no. But no is a powerful message.
And David, as we wrap up briefly, what are you watching for going forward?
I'm watching for whether or not the movement is able to sustain itself and forge connections between sort of the traditional protest behavior, the big demonstrations, civil disobedience actions, and more conventional political activity, like testifying in congressional hearings, like supporting candidates for office. I'm also watching to see how sticky the protests at the grassroots are. Are opponents of the Trump agenda going to start running for school board and turning up at town meetings? And if that happens, we're quite likely to see a long period of unrest and some substantive change.
We'll leave it there. David, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's David Meyer, professor of sociology and political science at the University of California, Irvine. His books include The Politics of Protest, Social Movements in America. He blogs at politicsoutdoors.com.